working on, I hope, a book on the South in the decade or two before the civil rights period began. That is to say, up to 1954 and not beyond there. A lot's being done now, a lot's already been done on the period from 54 on. And I'm really interested in getting into that period from, say, about 1938 toward the end of the Depression, just before World War II began, and then particularly after the war, when so much was changing in the nation and the world, and there was such a sense of possibility for improved life for people in the South, and yet we had a still serious problem on the whole racial issue that we were struggling to find a way to address. And it's that period there when people were trying to figure out how to address that issue that I'm particularly interested in right now. I thought I'd begin by asking you.
I don't know that I can help you much.
Well, I think you can. I think you can.
I'm in the legislature.
Yes, sir. I was going to ask you what.
I wasn't aware in retrospect of a great deal of racial turmoil.
Uh huh. Well, I've got a few.
Just kind of accepted the old system.
Right. I got a few fairly specific things I want to ask you about, but I wanted to begin by asking you what the first elected office you held was.
First elected office was member of the House of Representatives.
And you, what year was that?
35.
In 35?
Mm-hmm.
And did you stay in the legislature then continuously until the war, till you went to the service?
Yes.
In the House or in the House
Both.
And Senate?
Both.
When did you go into the Senate?
I think it was about 41. I think it turns a session, 35 session, 37 session, 39 session, although I know I was in the House 41 when I first in the Senate.
41 was.
And I was serving that until I resigned in the middle of the term to go into the military.
And you resigned about when?
It was 1942.
44. Uh-huh.
I'd been in the Senate, I think, for two sessions.
I see.
Uh-huh. In those days, we really just had one session every 2 years.
Right, right.
Now, since that time, they have them all the time.
Right. You were Speaker of the House, weren't you?
No.
No.
I was suggested, I mean, there was a support for me for Speaker of the House in 37.
Mm-hmm.
39, but it didn't work out because of his current resistance to what was happening in Little Rock.
Well, Governor, let me use that as a sort of a linchpin to connect me back to this period that I told you I wanted to talk
yeah.
about. By 1957, there was no doubt in anybody's mind that if you were going to make social change in the South, you were going to have to do it by force. The masses of white Southerners were totally opposed by 1957 to any kind of racial, social rewriting of the social contract.
I wouldn't say the masses. Now, I always had the feeling that there were a lot of people out there
that
wanted me to do what I was doing.
Yeah.
And say what I was saying.
But they were afraid.
Now, I wasn't just blazing out for total desegregation in that period of time. I couldn't have accomplished anything had I been in that role.
Right.
And I had a huge program for educational reform and another reform
right.
that I was interested in as governor.
So I had to, I don't mean go along with the mob. I didn't go along.
No,
with them,
but you had to take them into account.
I had to take that into account.
Right.
And then take and how that would affect the totality of what I was able to do. And if I had done more than I did, I think I would have rendered myself impotent to do almost anything.
Uh-huh.
And so I was walking a kind of a tight rope there.
Right.
But still, there were events, as events happened, where it impelled me to say what I believed and what I thought was right.
Right.
And the course I thought we should follow.
Right.
And, of course, that set in motion a lot of antagonism toward me and toward us. We had the Ku Kluxes riding around the mansion right over here, burning the torches at night.
Right.
I went out on the porch. I thought that would be a showing that they weren't backing me down or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
And these highway patrolmen came and got me and hustled me over. That's crazy for you to stand out here. They may have some guns.
Golly.
You don't know what they got or what they're going to do.
Mm.
And so it was tenuous. And yet I could, every time I sat down and made a speech or to the people of Florida and talked to them about a number of occasions that, and circumstances that developed, I felt a deep affinity with a rather large group of people who believed I was right, and I was right in saying what I was saying. Now, I had more people who felt I was wrong. And some of those were rather tolerant of my being wrong, but they just felt I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think so. And I made a speech to the people of Florida in connection with the sit-in demonstrations at the lunch counters, which was very forthright.
Yeah, I said
these people would be invited to come in and patronize a business. And then say they couldn't buy at a certain counter,
right,
or a certain place, or a certain commodity.
Right.
That doesn't make any sense at all. Well, I think most people felt I was right about that.
Well, I think what a lot of people felt...
A lot of people were up in arms about it, because they thought I ought to be out there marching with the sticks and resisting those demonstrators.
Well, history has certainly proved you right. There's no question about that.
I feel that. I feel that very strongly.
Gardner, with all that in mind, if you think about, let's just take the year 1938. You were in the House of Representatives. Claude Pepper was in the Senate. Frank Porter Graham was the president of the University of North Carolina. There were people in Congress and in some governor's offices. A little bit later on, Ellis Arnold got elected governor of Georgia. Franklin Roosevelt was in the White House, and it was okay for people in the South, if you were a Democrat, to say, I'm liberal, I'm progressive, I'm for improving conditions for poor people and whatnot. As long as you stayed off the race issue and didn't start talking about social integration and that kind of business, it was okay to be a liberal then. And then we got into a war that was really a war for a liberal cause. It was against a racist dictator in Germany.
But let me interrupt you there to underscore what you just said. We had a miserable school program.
Right.
For our public school,
right,
because we had a system of just local support, and we had school districts. Every county was divided into school districts, and each school district even voted on how much taxes they should pay on land in that district. And I saw very early and was involved in the campaign to develop public support for a statewide acceptance of responsibility for public schools,
right,
for a minimum level of education.
Right.
and state support for public schools everywhere. And this had no race lines in it. It just applied to children, and they accepted that, and the people were proud of really that that move forward that we made back in 37 or 39, I don't know which one of those years, but I was still in the legislature because I was chairman of the education committee, and I I'd gone all over the state making speeches to PTA groups and all about Florida must awaken to new responsibilities and to just leave our children out there, whether they were black or white or what, but leave them out there without an opportunity for a decent education was a sin and a crime, and that we just did not want debasing our state with. And that program, when it was first proposed, was a little unpopular. Largely, I think, because of business reasons and worry about the taxes. But as we carried that campaign, it caught on fire. And while the legislators were at one point were very much opposed to it because they felt a popular opposition to it, before we got when we got it ready to go, the public was very much behind it. That all happened in this period of time.
Just before the war started. And then
people weren't thinking in terms of segregation and desegregation, and maybe they assumed they'd still have segregated schools.
I think everybody assumed that at that point.
They thought that.
Now then, you went into the service, and when you came back home in 1945, Here was a sort of, and you went back to the Senate, I assume, in 45?
Yes. I got elected before I came back.
Who was the governor?
The war was over. And
Who was governor then?
Millard Caldwell.
Millard Caldwell. Do you think, looking back on that time, that at that point, given what you had been involved in before the war and then your own wartime experiences, when you came back to resume a life of public service, do you think that the issue of race as unfinished business for the South to deal with became a part of your thinking at that time, or was it later?
Well, I knew that that discrimination based on race would always be an issue until it was settled. I didn't think in terms of any Supreme Court issuing a ruling that it was unconstitutional. I always felt, and I publicly said, that reform should come in other ways and by interpretation by the Supreme Court.
Ought to come from within the state?
Within the legal processes available for law change and all that. That's the way I kind of visualized. I felt that there was, honestly, I felt that that was a rather bold and to a degree unsupportable move on the part of the Supreme Court of the United States to try to tell us what kind of schools to run down here in the South and everywhere, everywhere. I had some of that feeling that this should have come by act of law.
Yes, sir.
And not the way it came. Actually, of course, in retrospect, it never would have come by operation of law, I don't suppose.
It probably
certainly
never would have.
Not in our lifetime.
No. It probably never would have.
Yeah. I praise the court now.
Yes, sir.
And of course, much all the time, most sense. But in its immediate impact, it seemed to me to be a rather raw interference, you know, with the state responsibility. I wanted the state to meet its responsibility. And that responsibility could lead to desegregation. But I had the feeling at first, after that decision came out, that it was questionable. But then as time went on, and that we went through this adjustment period. Well, I realized I was wrong about that.
Well, you know, even
that Supreme Court,
even in that time of the, let's just say right after the war, Florida, though of course it had many problems, compared to some of the other southern states, it didn't look all that bad. It didn't have a poll tax, for example.
Yes.
It didn't have a white primary. As a matter of fact, in 1947, your state senate rejected an effort to make a white primary the pattern for Florida.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Senator John Matthews from Jacksonville who introduced into the Senate a law, a bill to make the Democratic primary for whites only. And it was voted down in 1947.
Jack Matthews introduced that?
Yep, he sure did. And you must have voted against that.
I don't know.
You remember that?
I don't remember.
Well, it happened.
I have some faint recollection. Talk about a white primary, but I didn't know it.
Did you see that very same year, Georgia under the Talmadges?
I would like to know how I did vote.
Yeah, I'll check on it. Georgia under the Talmadges implemented a white primary.
Yeah.
South Carolina tried to and got stopped by Judge Waring. You remember Judge J. Wade's Waring? Who ruled later on in that school case over in South Carolina. And indeed, the Supreme Court in 1944 outlawed the white primary in Texas. So this was in the wind, you see.
Yes.
And when it came to Florida, Florida wouldn't do that.
Now, you refresh me now. I remember that. I know.
And so, and then even on the issue of, there was a lot of agitation for a federal anti-lynch law.
Yes.
And in 1949, there was a particularly terrible lynching in Groveland, Florida.
Yes.
You remember? And Sheriff McCall ended up killing a couple of the...
Yes.
And that was in the papers for almost 3 years. A very emotional issue that kept coming up in the papers. And there were lynchings in other southern states.
What was that sheriff's name?
Willis McCall.
Yeah.
There were four black men implicated.
I was very much involved in that.
You remember that?
See, I was governor at that time.
In 49? When did you first become governor?
55.
Well, see, this was earlier. I think this was when
I had a huge fight with McCall over a lynching down there that actually amounted to almost...
In the 50s?
Yes.
That was another incident, but you see, McCall, he had a reputation for being a real...
I commuted a life sentence of conviction and the execution of a black man down there, and it was very, very unpopular. McCall had it. And I was right in the middle of my campaign.
Right.
Running for governor. First time.
In 55.
I was running for full term.
For the full term.
When you
took that partial term, what year was that? 54? Or 3, maybe?
No, it was 55. 55 and then 61 were my 6 years.
And you were elected in 57 to the full term.
Yes.
Yeah. 55. That was right after the Brown decision. Yeah. Well, McCall,
and,
the
Supreme Court justice now, what's his name, the black one that's been there so long?
Thurgood Marshall.
Thurgood Marshall was counsel in that case.
Right.
I remember
seeing. Uh-huh. Well, this other case...
The St. Petersburg Times supported me very strongly in commuting that to life imprisonment. That's all a governor could do.
Right.
In a situation like that.
Right.
That's all I could do. He'd been tried and retried and all. Courts had reviewed it and the courts had sustained it. And we were at a point where nothing else could be done.
Right.
And so I commuted to life in prison.
Uh-huh.
Just that rather sad story there. That was brought out in my campaign by Charlie Johns and great. Funeral was made by him about it in the campaign. And I went down and I talked. I made a talk down there to the people in that area.
Around Stark.
Yeah. And just told them, not Stark, but be down a little lower than that.
Uh-huh.
It was...
Where the crime was committed?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. They had a big annual watermelon festival.
I can't remember.
And
they
always invited the governor to come ride at the parade.
Mm-hmm.
And Sheriff McCall had gotten this woman who was involved and got her dressed up with a new dress. And when the car I was riding in the parade stopped, well, she ran over and told me who she was. And she said, suppose I was your sister, would you have done that? Would you have commuted that sentence? And I said, I think I would have. I hope I would have. But that's irrelevant here. Not down here for the purpose of talking politics or making political issues. Mm-hmm. I'm down here to help the community and be with the community.
Right.
And she wasn't in there. But McCall had set her up for that.
Yeah. He was a very devious man.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's still alive.
Is he?
Somebody's going to write a real book about him when he dies.
Yeah.
He tried to do it now. He was pretty devious, but he was also pretty cautious.
What is that county where Groveland is?
That was Lake County.
Lake County?
I believe so.
And you think that's where he still lives?
Well, I guess he still lives there. I asked somebody not so long ago. But he was in Marion County. I associate him with Marion County, too. And I'm not just quite sure where he's living now. I have no idea. But there's a lot of material out there. And the St. Petersburg Times got a huge file on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to make a real book.
Mm.
But I don't think anybody feels like that they could do it until he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've got to...
Some pretty terrible stuff went on there.
Terrible stuff in there.
Yeah.
And they'd at least have litigation about it, which would be very difficult to manage.
Well, this case that happened earlier...
And the victim of that has died.
Yeah. But this earlier case, the crime happened in 49, and... Oh, I bet I'm making a connection now. I know what happened. The crime was in 49. A white man was killed and four blacks were implicated. One of them was hunted down and killed by a posse, and the other three were captured. And they had trials, and one of them was sentenced to life in prison, and the other two were sentenced to death. And those two were being transported by Sheriff McCall to some other prison, and he tried to kill them both.
Yeah.
He killed one of them, but the other one survived and was subsequently retried and resentenced.
That's the one.
That's the one.
He commuted his sentence to life in prison. Now, he was out pretty soon, not during my time, but he was paroled. He had an excellent record. He was fine.
He didn't commit the crime, I don't think.
I don't think he did.
No,
either.
That's ties it together.
Four. No, now you got. We must have two cases.
You think there is two?
This case had to do with attempted rape of this woman.
This is a different case.
And he was down by a lake, and these boys, four of them, had gotten this car. That I don't think it was questioned about them having the car. They hadn't stolen it.
Uh-huh.
But they were down there, and they had, and one of the basic pieces of evidence that they convicted them on was that they got tire prints from the lake bottom, and they matched the tire prints of the car, which they took into possession.
Uh-huh.
Now, questions were raised later that those tire prints were manufactured by a deputy sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
he was convicted of manufacturing tire tracks in another case.
I see.
Later on. And so that gave a certain amount of possible validity to that. But
yeah.
There were four of these black boys. Now, some of this ties into what you were mm-hmm. saying, though, and I don't know.
I'll have to go and do some more reading on that.
If you're going to go into that case,
yeah.
Well, that's going to take
a lot of digging. Well, I wanted to bring it up because...
incidentally, just to get a trauma and the drama of it, he was paroled and went to work down in Miami. And one of the conditions of his parole was he might go back to Lake County. That's the county where that
mm-hmm.
was. And I followed him the rest of his life. But he just made a marvelous record down there, working for this man. Just was very much pleased with him.
Mm-hmm.
And believed in him and came to trust him tremendously. And he wanted to go back home, visit with some of his relatives. He couldn't do that under the conditions of the parole. They waived this, though, and let him go back with the understanding he would do certain things that he would not go back into that immediate area,
mm-hmm.
to another place, visit with his uncle or his relative, and that he wouldn't engage in any kind of a controversy with anybody about
uh-huh.
the case.
Right.
And so he went back on those terms, and he was sitting in a chair on the front porch of his uncle's house, and he just toppled over dead in a heart attack. Died right there.
Uh-huh. Soon after he was released, or had he been...
No, he had been... He just on a little mm-hmm. furlough kind of thing.
Yeah,
he could go up and see him.
I see.
But the authorities were afraid that the white people would get all disturbed about him coming back.
Yeah.
You know, they knew about it.
Uh-huh.
So they were upset about it. Then you got to wondering whether there was any possible foul play on
right.
the part of Sheriff McCall or anybody
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
But McCall lives on. I don't know
mm-hmm.
how long he's going to live.
Yeah.
He's getting up there.
He must be about the same.
Mm-hmm.
Probably be about the same. Florida didn't go with the Dixiecrat revolt in 1948. Why do you suppose that was? Why didn't the state become a Strom Thurmond Dixiecrat stronghold?
48.
Mm-hmm. That's the year they broke out of the party. They left the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia because of a civil rights plank in the party platform. You know, President Truman had a civil rights program that he tried to implement in the 40s, and all of the southern governors were and senators were opposed to it.
I don't know how to explain that, except the fact that we are having an increasing population in development. People moving here from the north, and so the most of that Dixiecrat stuff is kind of old-time South
mm-hmm.
stuff, you know, and rural
mm-hmm.
dominated and encouraged, and that population increase would have something to do with it. Because most of the people moving in here were moving from other environments
right.
where they didn't have this feeling
uh-huh.
about race like existed down
right.
here. Of course, there was a lot of good relationships too that went on during that period of time. And a lot of good people in the South were reluctant to just change moderately and reasonably and but they didn't want any violence. They wanted to maintain the old system, you know, of mm-hmm. being kind and gentle mm-hmm. And having black friends. And mm-hmm. some of my best friends were black, you know, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And there was a genuine love relationship
yeah.
between a lot of black people and white
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
But still, a tolerance for the desegregated posture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the simple rightness or the wrongness of that Dixiecrat concept
mm-hmm.
Just lost its strength here because of just not wanting to be associated with a mm-hmm. rebellious violent
right.
They didn't want Ku Klux Klan,
right.
So they didn't want the lynchings, and mm-hmm. they didn't want much of any of that kind of. They wanted blacks to be treated well
mm-hmm.
and to live well and to come to live better. But they still had in mind that they would always be coming to the back door, and it would always
yeah.
be Mr. and Mrs. White right. people, and
mm-hmm.
Sam and Mary, black people,
right.
and this kind of thing.
And they really couldn't envision that changing in any way without the whole structure falling down.
Well, I think they could envision some gradualism toward that. Some good, I don't know how many.
It's
very firm.
As you look back on that now.
But it was a little easier, I think, in Florida than it was in most other states.
Uh-huh, I think it was too.
And we were going forward with pretty progressive school improvement.
Right.
And of course that was on a separate but equal basis.
Mm-hmm.
But they were proud to get even on a separate basis.
Mm-hmm.
So the black people were not as, maybe not as recalcitrant, or not as they
weren't rebellious
they
at
weren't
that point.
Rebellious at that point.
Yeah. As you look back on that now, does it? I don't want to give you too much of a leading question, but I wonder if that period between the end of the war and say the early 50s, now seems in retrospect as a sort of a golden opportunity that we missed to make social change peacefully without going through all of the bloodshed and turmoil that subsequently came.
I think that's true.
If we had only been able to see what was down the road, we would have maybe been willing to make those changes.
That's right.
But we weren't able to see it.
And it was difficult for people to make changes without being forced in
yeah.
some way to do it.
Right.
Because that put them in a posture of being nigger lovers or
right.
whatever. And they
And yet all of our public efforts were to resist forcible change. We kept saying, leave us alone, you Yankees, Congress, the courts, whoever, and let us work out our own problems down here in a peaceful way, and we'll do it. We were saying that all the way through the 40s, but we never did. We kept saying we don't need a federal lynch law. If you'll leave us alone, we'll work it out. But we kept on lynching folks.
Right.
And we said we don't need a anti-poll tax law.
We didn't keep lynching, but
somebody did.
Renegade.
Right.
Did.
And we said we don't need an anti-poll tax law. If you'll leave us alone, we'll let black people vote. But we found all kinds of ways to keep them from voting, you know. Some states worse than others. Some kept that poll tax right on up to the time of the Civil Rights Act. Of course, Florida was not one of those, but Alabama and South Carolina and Virginia and Georgia had a poll tax, and if you look at the figures on the percentages of blacks who were registered and who voted, it was minuscule.
Yeah.
So
I think it's a mistake to assume that the abolishment of the poll tax was something to help, was visualized and sponsored to help black people and approve that position.
It didn't, in effect, have that.
I don't think it had that racial connotation. I think that now Senator Hollum here is—he was very much of the old school.
He was a very conservative.
And he was conservative to the end.
Right.
He was with the Virginia people.
Right.
And but at the same time, he sponsored that here. What he was resisting, and I felt deeply the same thing, the use of the poll tax as a device for buying votes.
Yeah. Right.
And they were buying white votes.
Right.
It's just probably more importantly, they were buying black ones.
It supported
black ones were voting.
It supported machine politics,
right.
Courthouse gang politics.
That's right.
That's why.
The first race I ever made for county prosecuting attorney, I got beat by that same thing.
Uh-huh.
By that same type of thing.
Uh-huh.
I was running against a prosecuting attorney that was in the courthouse.
Was that here in Leon County?
Right.
Because you grew up in this county, didn't you?
Yes. I was born there.
Yes, sir.
Born to three doctors.
Yeah.
But our feeling about the poll tax, we've got all kinds of stories about they'd give them the poll tax receipt and, you know, out there to vote. And they'd pay it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the bosses.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they were... And the bosses and then the courthouse rings were
mm-hmm.
all tied together.
Right.
Community kind of bosses.
Right.
And the courthouse rings.
Right.
And I know, I lost that election by about 100 votes. I was just 21, 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
When I made that.
Yeah.
But I lost by 125 votes.
Mm-hmm.
And they could easily count back in those votes that they procured unlawfully.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of happy to see Hollum come forward with that.
Yeah.
And he got excited about it when it got to be a kind of a national thing. You know, he was first interested in it as a state.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether what we did about that as a state before it got to be a national.
You got rid of it here.
Yeah,
you got rid of it here ahead of most of the other states.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about another.
But he followed it up in Washington
right.
as a senator.
Right.
On the national level.
And yeah.
He ultimately got a national constitutional amendment adopted. It abolished it.
Yeah. Thinking about the election of 1950 when George Smathers beat Claude Pepper and took his seat in the Senate. It was that same fall that Frank Porter Graham lost his seat in the Senate from North Carolina. And one or two other races, I can't remember now what they were, but it was sort of a turning point in a way where some ostensibly liberal voices, progressive voices of Southern public figures were extinguished by much more conservative voices. And race was a part of that. The larger part was the whole communism thing, the Red Scare.
Right. That's true.
And it seemed to me that by 1950, the combination of those two fears.
I don't think race had much played much a part in that.
Not too much.
As I recall.
No.
I don't think Pepper was out, for example, crusading for black people voting.
Not too much. Doesn't show up too much.
Improving their welfare and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he did that.
He, in fact, if you examine his record real carefully, he never had much to say about race.
No.
Never did.
He didn't. Not for the whole way.
Right.
Until right toward the end.
Yeah.
He did.
Did you attach any particular significance to that election? I mean, did that signal to you a sharp turn to the right on the part of the electorate in Florida and in the country at large? You remember that you were still in the Senate then?
Yeah. there were more. There was another element that was quite important in that race, as I remember. And that was a controlled bolshevism down in Hillsborough County, where they had these Latin people voting, and where the bosses were delivering precincts 541 to Smadless and 2 to Pepper,
uh-huh.
and that kind of thing,
uh-huh.
which obviously was fraud.
Yeah.
It couldn't have been a...
Right.
We couldn't have been otherwise.
Right.
That was an element within that too. And I was jolted by that and recognized that we ought to take the steps to prevent that.
Mm-hmm.
Rampant control votes right here in my own races. I had some of the same thing. We had little communities like Miccosukee, Chairs, and Capitola, and Woodville, and around, all around. That where there were dominant leaders and people that could pretty well deliver these precincts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how they did it, I don't know. But I know I was victim. I lost several precincts. I think I
mm-hmm.
should have won
mm-hmm.
that way. But I don't think they were ready to accept me because they didn't know me. I was just a young boy,
uh-huh.
you know, kind of shouting in the wilderness there.
Mm-hmm.
And the other side had received favors and had been on a close relationship.
Yeah.
And that, somewhat naturally, I guess, would support the people that had been their benefactors.
Mm-hmm.
But all that was pretty much washed out, not just by the poll tax, not by any one specific thing, but just by the general level of improvement of education
mm-hmm.
and acceptance of responsibility,
right.
political responsibility,
right.
by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anybody could be elected now, anything in this country, just counting on you know, a few leaders to put
right.
it together.
Yeah.
Particularly in the rural areas, mm-hmm. they don't stand out
yeah.
as significant controlling influence
mm-hmm.
Hotbeds.
Uh-huh. You said a while ago that at the time the Brown decision came down, it struck you as a rather extreme
yes.
Thing for the Supreme Court to do, and you worried that it would be hard to make it stick. And yet, somewhere down the line, after you had been governor, you were head of the community relations and whatnot, you obviously changed your mind about
that. I did.
What do you suppose it was that caused you to change your views?
Well, I could see in retrospect that that was the only way it could happen, and that it should happen became very deeply implanted in my soul and conscience. I mean, I could see, the more I got closer to that issue and get away from accepting the old traditional mores of the South, why they stronger, I became a reformer.
Uh-huh.
And
you have no misgivings now about the way that turned out?
No, I don't. I don't. I wish I didn't have to explain that I didn't always feel the same way
mm-hmm.
people wound up realizing that I felt. But it was just, it just took some time for me to assimilate that and the experience of time and the experience of dealing with people in public office as governor. I remember distinctly when I was standing up there making my acceptance speech at my inauguration as first governor, looking out at that crowd. And there was thousands of people out there, and there were black ones, and there were white ones, and there were all kind of colors. Mm-hmm. And I told my wife after that, I said, this I just felt an enlargement of responsibility for those people out there. I was the only governor they had.
Right.
I was the only governor they had. And they all seemed to feel excited and anxious and supportive. And they just it really touched me very deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea of obligation to eradicate influences that were morally wrong,
mm-hmm.
and fundamentally wrong, and against precepts that I'd talked about and preached about in churches,
mm-hmm.
and brought up in the Sunday schools to understand, I just felt that couldn't be adjusted with
right.
belief in
yeah.
right and wrong.
Right.
That it's just wrong to see this happening.
Do you suppose
that had more, I think, an honest, genuine awareness that those people out there had a right to depend upon me.
Right.
And I wanted them to have faith in me. And that faith I saw went beyond just accepting the status quo. Find a new way.
Right.
Do new things.
Yeah.
And,
you know, Governor, maybe in the way things work in life,